This podcast is brought to you by our friends at Honey Badger.
Your code is going to have errors, even code written by an amazing developer such as yourself. When bad things happen, it's nice to know that Honey Badger has your back. Honey Badger makes you a DevOps hero by combining error monitoring, uptime monitoring, and cron monitoring into a single, easy-to-use platform, saving you time and your cash. Remote Ruby listeners get 30% off for 6 months. Simply mention Remote Ruby when signing up and they'll apply the discount to your account. No credit card required.
This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
Hello.
What's up, Jason?
Why wasn't I here last week?
Or the week before, right?
I was here the week before. I was called the week before that one.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I was trying to trace down a bug with Cable Ready and Morphdom and how they work together. And I didn't solve it until 5 o'clock. So that's why I wasn't here.
What was the issue?
The issue is very subtle. My coworker actually found it, Kyle. When you use Cable Ready's morph, it sends over, when it calls Morphdom, it's actually calling it with a document fragment. So not like an element, not a string, an instance of a document fragment. And if you dig into Morphdom's library, there is a test that's written that says if you try to replace, like you try to morph with a document fragment, it's not going to morph. It's going to just straight up override, like replace. So the problem we had, like it's so subtle, but we were using Cable Ready, saying morph, and we couldn't get data permanent to work. And that's because it's doing a full replace. And so I was like, this can't be a problem because Reflex doesn't have this problem. Like they can use data attributes for permanent. And if you look at Reflex, it's always used in children true. It's only like morphing the children. And so there's something about if you use children only true and morphed them with a document fragment, it actually works. It's when you're not using children only and you're just doing a straight up morph, it just replaces.
Yeah. So it's because of that parent element then, something about that causes that difference. Huh.
If you like give it inner HTML instead of a document fragment, it will do the morph, including the parent. No problem, which is what we need because we're migrating like legacy views and they're very dependent on like each section's a component and they are siblings and the way, because of a lot of legacy reasons, they have to stay siblings. And so like I couldn't wrap it and just do children only because then it broke everything. So
yeah,
we ended up, I opened an issue on Cable Ready because I'm not sure it's a bug per se. And if it is, it feels like maybe it's something I should deal with in Morphdom. But yeah, I like got it locally working in Reflex too by changing it to not use inner HTML and children only from Reflex. Then it started working. But at that point, we just rewrote in 15 minutes, we just rewrote Cable Ready's morph because we already had an action cable channel. And something like it was subscribed to Morphdom. So literally all we, or to Cable Ready. So literally all we did was bring Morphdom in. And instead of calling like the magical like Cable Ready stuff, we just did our own morphs. And
yeah, it is interesting. Like maybe it's one of those where you add an option into the morph method on Cable Ready or if there's a solution for it that could work in all cases, then obviously that is the better route to go. But sounds like maybe it needs to be a option or something in Cable Ready or at least documented. I mean, right now you assume that it's going to do a full morph. And if there's cases where it's not going to, then you want to know that. But yeah, it seems, I don't know, there must be a reason in Morphdom then why it doesn't do that. So it may be something you just have to work around as opposed to, I would assume they would have fixed that by now if that was a doable thing for that.
Yeah, we ended up just, I don't know. I didn't, if I patch cable ready in production, I then need to patch stimulus reflex. Like, it's not just one or the other, because we use reflex really heavily. Mm. And so, because for this, we literally only have one morph call we reuse everywhere. It always takes the same structure. Like, for us, it was like, okay, let's just, it was like 20 lines of JavaScript. That was a weird way to start the episode. But yeah, it was really fascinating. I feel weird. I don't know. Because I don't know if it's a bug, but it feels like a bug. But then I hate being like, hey, I found a bug. Because I don't know.
It happens. When you're, especially with something like that, when you're like, they didn't write morph DOM. It just relying on it. There's nuances to it. And it is what it is. So hopefully it's something that's reasonably fixable that maybe is just an option or something. You could always introduce another, like maybe cable ready needs another method or something entirely to be called instead of, I don't know, intermorph or something like that. Add to the API or whatever if it's a explicit thing that needs to be handled.
The question of whether stimulus reflex should fork morphdom has come up several times, and Nate is very anti forking morphdom, but there have been several things that have come up where there are some people in the community who are proponents of doing that because it would allow us to do X, Y, or Z. This kind of sounds like one of them. Also, Jason, are you eating Chick-fil-A?
Totally eating Chick-fil-A.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I'm so hungry. It just hit me out of nowhere and now I need it. But yeah, we've had things pop up. So far, we've been able to patch everything. I wouldn't be surprised if maybe you run into something that just we can't really handle unless we did fork morph them or something like that.
I really don't know what to do. I think it's fixable without having to fork morph them, but I don't know. The thing that makes it tough is I don't know the side effects that it will cause for people using cable ready, people using stimulus reflex. I just don't know what like little things will pop up out of that. So that's why I've been kind of like treading it lightly so far.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you don't want to, I don't know, I'm sure there's alternatives too, but they're probably going to have their own nuances. And yeah, I can imagine you don't want to build your own from scratch and deal with all those things because then you're going to just have a buggier morph DOM. There's just a lot of inherent understanding built into that, which might be a little weird side effects, but replacing it is probably very tough in comparison to adding an exception or an option to handle that little case. Or like Active Record, you can replace the back end of MySQL, Postgres, whatever, but then you've got to build your own layer that tries to make them all work the same and they just don't. And that's a rabbit hole to go down. So that, yeah, that is almost certainly going to be a conversation of what do we do more than anything, because it's not an easy solution or an easy problem to solve.
And we want to keep using cable ready. Like, this is the only place in our app where we've gone rogue per se. And it's because it's so simple. Like, literally, we're just morphing. So we just render a component, broadcast it over action cable, and then just call morphdom on the like raw string, and it works. So we'll see what happens. And yeah, I don't know how to fix it at a morphdom level. I know how to fix it at cable ready and stimulus reflex level, but I don't know.
Right. Yeah, it'll probably be one of those open conversations of there's a thread or something on GitHub where everybody's like, here's all our frustrations about how we use morphdom. How can we improve this or, you know, extend things so that we can deal with those nuances a little bit more flexibly instead of just like we always just pass it the same way to morphdom. Yeah, it's a common thing on open source. And it's also like one of those things that as people, it's so flexible. Cable ready can be used for a million different things. And so when people start using it in ways that you never have tried or tested or even really care about supporting, you know, how do you make those decisions? That's hard because you've got to maintain it. And if you're trying to please people who are taking it in a whole different direction than you planned, that can be tough to support as a maintainer. So I'll be curious to see how that goes.
But yeah, what's up with y'all?
Well, I'm working on a new course, I think, which I'll probably officially announce pretty soon, but I want to get into all the metaprogramming and classes and modules and class variables and more advanced Ruby stuff that you use to build a framework or a gem or a DSL, that sort of thing. Those to me were, even auto-loading and stuff, and to me it was like foreign coming from Python, where every import is explicit and you know exactly where every class and thing came from. Then getting into Ruby and Rails, where everything's, there's this params method in your controllers and I don't know where that came from, and your routes, all those helpers and everything. Having been building Noticed and diving like deep into the metaprogramming aspects of that, I thought, yeah, maybe this is the time to go and turn it into a course and just teach all the stuff I wish I knew about Ruby when I started as a Rails developer. And seems like that's pretty appealing to everybody I've talked to about it so far. So that gives me some encouragement to go through it. So today I was recreating like the Rails configuration, DSL, kind of the route helpers and mapper and stuff, and recreated that from scratch in like a rudimentary version. That was pretty fun. So I think it'll be a good set of topics or whatever to dive into. Just there's a lot of little things like instance eval and like the idea that you can include a module on an instance, but not the entire class. People hardly ever do that, but it's doable. Have you guys heard of the Gilded Rose kata?
Yeah, you brought that up a few times, I think.
Yeah. So I went through that and did a screencast on it, like how I would normally refactor it and pull it out into like classes and do inheritance or whatever. And then James Edward Gray II's solution using modules, and just how like elegant and totally different it is from my solution. And it was a fun thing to go through, because reading through his solution again was like, dang, I don't use modules as much as I should. And that's one of those things that every time I get into the Rails source code, like there's a lot more modules than I normally write. And it's just nice to see that, as a lot of that, even in the routing helpers and the DSL, they're like grouped into modules for scoping and namespaces and HTTP helpers and resources. And they're just defined inside the class as modules and then immediately afterwards included into the class. So it's like you could totally put those inside the class, but by organizing it in modules, you have some encapsulation and organization around them, which I thought was cool. There's a lot of that stuff that I think is easy to skim over as you get into Ruby and Rails and you're like trying to build stuff, learning the sort of philosophy that you can apply to Ruby because it's so flexible is an interesting topic that I found really useful and eye-opening when I was reading like metaprogramming Ruby back in the day. That was probably the biggest eye-opener I had when I started learning Ruby. So yeah, that's what I've been up to. What about you, Andrew?
I am absolutely freaking drowning at work right now, if we're going to be totally upfront and honest, but I'm hanging in there. So it's been a challenging and or frustrating and also good learning experience, but I am also working on the podcast app for Rebase, and that's going along pretty well. And I have just been diving into the world of podcast hosting and podcast statistics and this and that, and audio streaming formatting, XML parsing, unfortunately, and stuff like that. So I guess talking about podcasts leads us into one thing we wanted to say, which is thank you so much to everyone who listed Remote Ruby as one of the favorite technical podcasts they were listening to on Planet Argonne's 2020 Ruby on Rails community survey, because I think it's listed second. And yep. I think all of us were blown away and humbled and excited and thankful that landed there.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing to see. And I think GoRails was like number two in the blog category. Shout out to everybody who voted for us. That's pretty awesome. It's one thing to sit here and talk to you guys over Zoom every week and hit publish and not have any idea what happens after that. But it's a great thing to see that, you know, people are listening and finding it useful, I think, is the most important thing. We have fun having these conversations, but it's even more fun to know that they're useful.
Yeah. Maybe if we want to increase the usefulness, maybe we should solicit listener questions or maybe some stuff they want us to talk about or guests they want us to bring on. But yeah, I like the format that we have now. But in case we want to and get to number one next year, I guess is really what the goal is. In order to get to number one, what do we have to do? Who do we have to pay?
Yeah, we should do, it would be fun to do an AMA kind of thing and collect questions on Twitter or something and then do a episode answering listener questions. That would be super fun. We should do that.
We could also live record one of these and like have a chat.
I thought about that.
Yeah, that would be good too.
That's definitely the way Remote Ruby like was when it was the meetup, was like I just fired up Google Hangouts and people would like chat and that was fun.
Yeah, that definitely is a good idea. Bring it back full circle. There we go.
Three quarter circle.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Building like the podcast network is something I've been just in about, and either streaming to YouTube or like posting, because like we have these videos, like we record the videos on Zoom and we currently only publish the audio. I've considered like putting them on YouTube automatically, or if not like the actual video, putting the podcast audio with the cool like overlay animation or whatever. But yeah, so I guess if you're listening and any of this sounds interesting, or there's like a podcast feed we're not on that you like, or you would like us to do an AMA or what have you, like feel free to, I guess, tweet us on the Twitter at Remote Ruby or all of us personally, or you can email me at andrew@rebase.fm. And I guess I'll take the bullet for anyone who would rather send it via email.
And it's at @remote_ruby on Twitter. I went to the wrong Twitter account recently too. Yeah. Eventually we're going to be famous enough that Twitter will just kick that person off and give us their account.
They have to.
Yeah. I think that's just how it goes. We're just that important. Oh man. When you were talking earlier, Andrew, I almost forgot, but this past weekend I installed Rails version 1.0 and it mostly running until the point that I tried to generate a scaffold, and then Postgres 12 changed some internal thing the PG gem was trying to read and couldn't. But yeah, boy, it's fascinating to look at that source code, because, you know, like I was talking about modules for organization and stuff, and like the Rails source code today is very well organized, and the Rails source code back then looks like something I wrote. It was like hilarious. It just felt disorganized or not quite. I mean, it had organization to it, but there was a lot less of the metaprogramming stuff going on, a lot more instance variables and things like that. And it was really cool to see. And then a fun fact was, in the generator docs, when you run the command, you can also use generators from other places, such as this login generator. And I was like, so Rails did have authentication, or like recommended something.
Don't tell me about that.
And as it turns out, the gem that it recommends there was a login system or something, login_system maybe on Ruby gems. And it was written by Toby from Shopify. And I was like, of course. So I just need to fire up like an old version of Postgres in Docker, and then I'm going to try and record a video on that. Because I downloaded the earliest version of Rails. So I like got on GitHub and went to the very first commit in the repo and cloned that and tried to run it. But I think they fixed some things in between that and version 1. And a lot of what you deal with that early version of Rails is, do these gems even exist or compile anymore? And some of it was like just bad version requirements. You know, they were like, you can use any of this dependency greater than this version, which is like that has had 7 major versions since then, and they're not compatible anymore. So you have to be a little careful to go back and install an old version. It was fun to go through Ruby Gems and look for everything from whatever year that original release was and try and install other gems that are similarly old. But it actually went surprisingly smoothly. It was a couple hours, I think, I fiddled with it, but had Rails up and running pretty quick after got the gems going. And Postgres was the only thing that like really made me a showstopper there, because I can't remember what I was doing. Maybe there wasn't SQLite or something. I don't remember. I don't know why I didn't have SQLite as a database, but something was related to that. Didn't have near as many features as it does these days. So it was quite a bit different, but it also felt awfully similar at the same time. Like you can see remnants of the original active support before it had a name and was like a gem. There's like the inflector in the repo and that. It was pretty cool. So I will probably revisit that here shortly and try and make a screencast out of it once I get a little bit of those things ironed out, because watching a 2-hour screencast of me fumbling around Ruby Gems is not the most fun.
Have you thought about live streaming any of that stuff?
I did. I did that, but it was like just poking around, install this gem. Nah, it didn't work. You know, go read some docs. Like it wasn't super fun to live stream, but
I don't know. I think about when we hang out and program on the weekend sometimes, like it's like that and I like it. I would enjoy just sitting there watching you like fumble around with that. But
yeah, I did live stream it. I don't know if it's public. I should make sure that it is, but yeah, I'll probably try and revisit that and live stream that as well. Cause it is fun to just like have that on in the background sometimes. One of my favorite programmers, Jonathan Blow, who's made a couple of cool video games, streams on Twitch all the time, and he's building his own programming language, and I just have him on Twitch in the background, you know, whenever he's working, and I don't really learn anything from it, but it's fun to like see him creating video games, which are a whole different level of and a programming language, which is way more complex than what I'm doing usually, but it's fun to do that. So I've been trying to do more live streams because those are a lot of fun.
What are you using for live streaming?
Just OBS.
Gotcha.
To YouTube.
Yeah, I've been using Streamlabs, which
is...
Yeah,
how do you like that?
I like it. It was easier to get running. I couldn't get OBS to like actually record my screen. So I don't know what the issue was. Maybe I'm just an idiot and I need to like try it again, but I really like Streamlabs.
Under products, they have Streamlabs OBS. Is that one a fork of OBS? One of them was like a premium, like someone turned it into the open source thing into more of a product. Couldn't remember if this was it or what.
It could be.
It's a ton of extra stuff.
I think Streamlabs is also open source, but they have, you can upgrade to premium to get things like your own website and a special themes and this and that. So Maybe
they have multi-streaming, so you could stream to YouTube and Twitch at the same time. That was something I thought about. That would be cool to have.
I do that with a different, I think Streamlabs has it built in now, or maybe it's a premium thing, but I was using something to do that. Because I was streaming on Twitch, YouTube, and Periscope, so that if you're on Twitter, like Periscope is like automatically at the top, so you could like just see that I was streaming. And probably watching like a code stream on your phone isn't that great, but that would then be able to link off to other stuff like Twitch and yada.
Yeah, that's cool. I forgot that Twitter made Periscope, so makes sense. Yeah, I feel like, I don't know, there's something fun about that and I want to do more of it. It's just a cool experience. And then I think being able to watch developers in their real environment, I try and do that as best I can with the screencast, but obviously to keep things as concise as possible in a video, you can't quite do that. So it's fun to have the live streams to really like see someone's workflow and like just see how they work. Cause it gives you, I mean, that's where I learned like, oh, I want to go spend time learning Vim. Cause Ben Ornstein's between him and like, oh, Gary Bernhardt, I was like, I need to learn Vim. These guys are insane at editing text, and like watching them work is what gave me the idea to go do that. So I think that will probably take off a ton in the future. I hope at least. I have to try out Streamlabs. Looks pretty nice. Got a lot of cool things, and that's sort of like the OBS is pretty bare bones. It's like your typical desktop like open source project. Little rough around the edges, definitely design-wise. Pretty rough. Let's face it. Your code is going to have errors, even code written by an amazing developer such as yourself. When bad things happen, it's nice to know that Honey Badger has your back. Honey Badger makes you a DevOps hero by combining error monitoring, uptime monitoring, and cron monitoring into a single, easy-to-use platform, saving you time and your cash. Honey Badger monitors and sends error alerts in real time with all the context needed to see what's causing the error and where it's hiding in your code, so you can quickly fix it and get on with your day. The included uptime and cron monitoring also lets you know when your external services are having issues or your background jobs go AWOL or silently fail. Go to honeybadger.io and discover how Star, Josh, and Ben created a 100% bootstrapped monitoring solution. Why is this important? Self-funding means they only answer to you, the developer, rather than a venture capital overlord. Remote Ruby listeners get 30% off for 6 months. Simply mention Remote Ruby when signing up and they'll apply the discount to your account. No credit card required. So Andrew, you were telling us before we started recording that you love putting code in the lib directory.
I'm screaming. Yeah, apparently. I guess for context, I've said this before, I'll just reiterate. I started learning Rails when Rails 5 came out. When Rails 5 came out, the lib folder at the root of your project is basically where your rig tasks go. I've seen people put a few things in there, but not really much. And it's definitely, in my mind, it's where the rig tasks go. And that's it. And like, I'm not going to open it unless I'm looking for a rig task. And apparently, it's a newer concept, and especially with auto-loading and the Zeitwerk. Right now, Zeitwerk auto-loads everything under your app directory. So I've seen applib before. I think in CodeFund, we had applib where we were, I think Nate monkey patched active storage in there and maybe a few other things. But that was kind of like, to me, it was kind of like a drawer of like, okay, what do we name it and where do we put it? So that was my understanding of that kind of architecture. But I've listened to a ton of old podcasts and I've heard terms like mixins, and they talk about the lib folder all the time. And it never really clicked, I guess. I've heard the term mixin a lot. I've never seen, or I never really even knew what it was, because like I've never seen it in an application before. And I guess the application I'm working on is, like I said, a legacy application, and it's been through several versions of Rails. And the one hard thing I'm having to deal with is like, okay, I see this thing in the UI. I'm trying to do something with it. How is this happening? Like, where is the code for this thing? And I realized when I was looking for something else, and I just found at the root of the project, we have a lib folder with, it does have rake tasks in it, but it also has a folder called mixins, which I guess like my brain didn't even comprehend or just like completely filtered out of my like view, because I didn't remember seeing it there before, and it never really occurred to me to look inside of it. And when I looked inside of it, I was like, oh my God, here is all the things I've been looking for. Like, I was like, this answers so many more questions. And that's just when I was like, wait, but why is it here? Why is it outside of app? Because it's clearly app code. And I was like, and why have I never seen something called mixins before? And these all look like concerns. And that kind of drew me down a rabbit hole of like, okay, why don't I know about this? Because obviously this was a thing in Rails. And I was like, why don't I know about it? Because I thought I knew our Rails app pretty well, but that is apparently only true for Rails 5 and going forward. So basically, the gist or my current understanding of it is that prior to Rails having a support for concerns, a lot of people used libmixins as basically a substitute. It's like the same idea as a concern where you can then include it or include files from there in your application and run them. And it seems almost like a drawer, but that's how I've seen lib used elsewhere as well. So yeah, I was just like... It was a frustrating and relieving experience, I guess, because I was like, okay, now I know where all this is. And I'm like, why did it take me so long to find this? Why is this here? What is this? Why Rails? Why? All the seven stages of grief or whatever I went through really quickly. Yeah, I guess I said to you pre-call, I feel like a lot of people don't know about this and I figure you guys do because you're old.
I never was called old until I started hanging out with you.
Okay. Here's a quick 1 minute explanation of that. When I first started working as a professional, a lot of people were like, oh, you're so young. Oh, this, oh, that. And it wasn't like shaming me for being young, but it was always like, I was always the youngest one in the room. And then once everyone found out, I was made to feel that way. So my defense turned into, I'm not that young. You're just an old fart. And that just became my thing. So yeah, you're old.
Oh God. Mixins were always like confusing for me when I got started because concerns weren't yet a thing, but like mixin and module is always, it's just used interchangeably, but it was very confusing to me when I was trying to learn that stuff. Like I remember like on vacation watching the same people who did Rails for Zombies, was it Code School? Some of the Code NV Labs, they had a video on like Ruby modules and they called it like a video on mixins. And I sat there watching it just so confused, but it's such a like simple concept. I like mixins actually a really good name for it because you're just mixing in functionality into a class. But my understanding of concerns is just that it's really just a wrapper around like Ruby module functionality, because you can do those same things with just pure Ruby.
Yeah, it's literally just like a tiny DSL over a module to give you that included block and then the class methods section. Yeah. It just like knows to include those as class methods, so you don't have to do class double greater than self, that sort of stuff. You don't have to remember that syntax anymore. And really, if you look up, I've looked into this before, the active support concern source code is like stupid simple because it's just, hey, if you have an included block, we'll go use that. And it's nothing fancy. Yeah. Did the other folders in the app directory, did those always get auto-loaded? Can't remember. I
feel like
maybe not forever.
Ever since I started Rails, which was like Rails 3.1, 3.2, I feel like everything in app was always auto-loaded.
Yeah.
Because the only time I ever tweaked with auto-loading is back before concerns when we did use just lib in the root directory. Like I would just auto-load lib, which was a hack, but I always got tired of killing my server and starting it back up every time I made a change there.
Yeah, that was the big nightmare of requiring stuff from lib because... it would not, unless you did it, it wouldn't auto-load it. And most people didn't do it because they copy-paste some stupid example off Stack Overflow that they didn't really understand. Yeah. There was definitely a time where I did little things and just threw them in config initializers because I didn't have to put them in lib and it was effectively the same thing. But there are also things that were only intended to be run once unless you do like a to prepare block, which Rails will rerun as it reloads your application. But yeah, I'm trying to think of, maybe I can find some old apps that I have that did have code in lib, but I don't really remember what we used it for. And it doesn't seem like most of the time it really needed to be there. Like it just wasn't there. A lot of this too, I think, is just people want Rails to give you some direction. Or you could always put it in app lib. You were saying CodeFund has that directory. And I just pulled that up on GitHub. In CodeFund source code, there's like an extensions module that's empty that just loads those things there to add features. Sometimes I would just put that in initializer, and I know we used to see people put that in the lib folder all the time because they're like, it's a library because it's modifying or patching active support or whatever. And you're like, but it doesn't totally make sense to be there. So
what always tripped me up about that though is I was confused. So before we were like using concerns, putting a lib directory in app, I was always confused about if I want to use a third party like library that isn't a gem, does it go in lib or does it go in vendor? And that always tripped me up because I know like vendor has stuff for assets too.
Yeah. And you can actually put your entire gems in vendor because vendor is like the original node modules. Like when you install a node module, it just copies the source code into node modules folder. And that's what vendor did too. So I remember we would pull down JavaScript libraries and put them in there and cross your fingers that no one edited them because the whole point of that was like pull down a third-party library and cache it so you have that exact version as a safety net of like if they yank the gem from Ruby gems or we don't have internet or something, we still have the source code in our repo. And I guess that was helpful, but that's not really a problem anymore or something we worry about. But yeah, as far as I know, the vendor was like similar to that, but I don't use that anymore at all either.
I used it when I swapped from ActionText to that paid editor that I use. I put that in vendor and because I can pull that into Webpack from vendor and it works pretty well. But yeah, after concerns came out, what I found myself doing is code that like I wanted to mix in. Actually still will just, so for components, for example, like view components, I'll make like a concerns directory, even if I don't even use active support concerns, like just anything that's like a mix in, any kind of module that will like be shared between concerns, I'll just throw in the concerns directory. So like I have like controllers concerns, models concerns, components concerns, interactors concerns, like just any kind of thing. I like that paradigm. Like I like that it has a name and whether it's active support concern or not, I know what that folder represents.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think of an example, but do you ever have code that isn't a module or a class? Because the autoloader is really designed around you have a matching module or class inside that file and it's going to reload that, but not necessarily like the other code in there. Like in those cases, do you put them in initializers or like a lib folder or something? Or do you even have those very often anymore? Because I don't think I'm having a hard time remembering when the last time I did something like that, I didn't just put in an initializer or something.
At work, I don't use it too often, but we have an app lib directory too. I try not to put stuff in there because it feels like the same problem of lib at the root level. I'm still not clear what it does, like what should be in there, but that is a thing we do.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Everything I've seen, it's like lib is basically a drawer.
Yeah, because like the CodeFund extensions stuff is like an empty module that will be auto-loaded, but then the lines underneath it are adding extensions to active storage or date or whatever. And like, I don't think I would put those, I would put the modules in a app extensions folder. I wouldn't put it in app lib extensions. I'd probably create a extensions folder. But then I think these actual like active storage blobs send include this extension, I would probably put that in an initializer, like a extensions initializer, and then use the Rails to prepare as well, because I think this isn't necessarily going to reload those extensions. So if you ever changed one, you might actually have to reload the whole Rails server in order to get that. And you probably aren't changing those very often, so they don't really need to adhere to that, but the Rails to prepare block is something that like when I was testing out the PayGem, we're including modules in a couple places. And in order to get them to dynamically reload, you have to do the to prepare block. Because if you reload a class that includes that module and you've included the module dynamically like this, then the reloaded version of it won't have your include happen automatically. So you have to use, you have to hook into the reloader or the autoloader when it reloads to re-inject your extension, your module. So yeah, it gets a little tricky when you start doing stuff like that. But if you're building an engine like we were in the PayGem, it's a normal thing you do is just include that stuff in the engine's initializer somewhere in there. But when it's at your own app, you're not writing as much of that stuff, and it would probably have to live in a initializer somewhere or application RB, which I wouldn't want to put it there, I don't think, because I'm not going to look there for extensions to be configured or set up.
There, I'm pretty sure, and I'd have to go look back, but I'm pretty sure there's somewhere in the initializers where we do load that stuff. That sounds very familiar. And I guess tangential question is, because whenever I've heard people talk about monkey patching gems, they're always like, I put it in app lib, or I put it in the lib folder, and then they don't, it's not okay. Is this the top level? Is this under app? Whatever. So if you guys are monkey patching a gem, where do you put that code?
So before we get into that, I just pulled up, you guys do have config initializers extensions.rb, which has a specific line here to reload on a to prepare block that extensions file that includes those. So that's what you're doing. I don't think I would put those four lines of actually doing the includes in the extension file itself. I would probably just put it here instead. But yeah, so you guys were doing that. So
you hear that, Nate? Chris doesn't agree. Chris doesn't agree. Come here and defend yourself.
It's one of those things that, like, the autoloader always expects you to just have a file with a class or a module defined in it. So anything that lives outside of that, I try and avoid writing in there. And I try and put it in an initializer or something. And so that file does have lines outside the module, and I would try and just avoid that there. It is what it is. To your question, what refresh me on that? What were you just talking about?
If you are going to monkey patch a gem, where are you going to put that code?
Yeah, I usually will put it in initializer, but I that's what I used to do before I knew how to hook into the reloader, because that's something that I want to, especially if I'm working on monkey patching, I'm going to want that to be reloaded so I don't have to restart my app every time, because I definitely used to do it the hard way and just restart the Rails server time and time again, and it was terrible. I would do like you have in CodeFund, where you've got your initializer that will go and do the include and kick off the monkey patching, and then define your extension as a module, or your monkey patch as a module that can go and override whatever it needs to or add to the to do its monkey patching. So in this case, like adding stuff to active support or active storage blobs, have your extension initializer in the to prepare block, inject it, and contain all your code in that module. Now it's a weird thing, because it's not a, you know, you don't want to put it in any of your normal app controller concerns or model concerns, because it's not a module for either one of those. And then that's just where I would go and create a app, probably extensions folder, and just use that as a place where I'm going to extend anything. Could be the string class, could be active storage, could be whatever, and just put them all in that one place. You can nest them under app lib, but I'd rather just see it at the top level. It's one more folder. Maybe if there was 100 extra folders at the top level, then I'd start organizing them down. But it's really easy to know at a glance when I open up the app folder, oh, we're extending things, because I see the extensions folder. If you throw it under lib, I'm going to have no idea or not notice it. So I like to put them more at the high level if I can. Like the notifications gem I just made. App notifications is where all your notifications are defined. And then you can tell, yeah, this is a core concept of the app and that's how it works. So I like more of the top level folders.
Yeah, I guess that made, like at first I was like, eh, but I guess I'm on board because when I think about the way I typically, if I'm going into a new app, the directories I go to first, and I'm not going to go through my list. I wrote it down somewhere and I'm going to tweet it or do something with it one day. But one of the steps in there is I open up app, and if I see a folder that I don't like understand or that's not Rails convention, I'm not talking about presenters or decorators. Like I know what those are, serializers. Yeah. It's not Rails standard, but it is, I think, like programming in Rails standard to have those types of folders. Like I know what those mean, but if I see anything else, I'm going to go immediately figure out what's going on in there. So extensions would probably be a folder. I'd be like, okay, what's that? And then go dig in. Forum, which is the dev.2, like they changed their name to Forum, like Forem on GitHub. And they have a folder in app called Black Box. And as soon as I opened up app, I immediately scanned the folder list. I was like, okay, what's that? And immediately went there. So I guess if there was something named extensions, I would probably check that like pretty early on in my like investigation of the app. So yeah, I guess I'm down. Lib to me, like once again, if I saw it at the top, I'm like, okay, that's a drawer.
Yeah.
And not like dig in too much further because I guess I just, not a lot of code that I've been exposed to is under lib.
Yeah. I see it as, what does lib even mean? It's not descriptive of what's inside of it at all. And I think it's easy to ignore that way. Black box at least is an intriguing name and you're like, what is that? But lib, you're like, okay, lib, we see that just like the bin directory and every other source code repo. I don't know. It's interesting because like you have a lib folder in gems, but when it's a gem that it lives, all the gem source code lives in lib, but they don't put like another lib inside of that when they have code that you don't know where it belongs or whatever, then they usually either put it at the top level or in another folder or something. So like the idea of a lib folder in your app just easily becomes a junk drawer because you don't really know what it means. So if you can get by with making it more descriptive of like extensions and services or clients or whatever you want to call your, if you're integrating with a lot of third-party things, you can make a clients folder that's all your third-party API clients that you've written. For example, in Hatchbox, I have app providers folder, and it's like hosting providers like DigitalOcean, AWS, and so on. And that's where I define all my API clients for those hosting providers. And it's more easy for me to remember that because I'm thinking of, oh yeah, I need to go check the API code for this. And I know where to look a lot quicker than if I threw that under a lib folder. I'd probably forget a lot. And there's a few things in that where the naming wasn't great. So I still, on a regular basis, I'm like, where was that code? And if you ever catch yourself doing that, it's probably a good sign that you need to go reevaluate the naming of something or organization of it if you find yourself scratching your head here and there.
This has been a hot tip brought to you by...
by Chick-fil-A?
No. I reject that. Taco Bell wants to talk. Then...
there you go. They got rid of a bunch of good food though. What are you going to do about that? How are you bringing... when are you going to bring back my caramel apple empanadas, man?
I don't know if that's on the list of things I would get from Taco Bell.
They were so good.
I didn't know they took them away. Those empanadas were like...
yeah. They got rid of the potato soft tacos and a ton of other stuff that
they brought that back.
Wow.
Taco Bell, just they bring stuff back, dude. It's like a hype cycle.
We'll go take the Remote Ruby Army and go tweet at them until they bring up back what we want.
Well, yeah. I was on... like in 2009, Facebook was still kind of newish. Burger King took away the cheesy tots. And that was like death to me. And I made a Facebook group that was like, bring back cheesy tots, like as a joke. And like, it had like 110 people join it, just like randos from all over the US.
That's awesome. If they got rid of the chicken fries, I'd be sad.
Remember what a big deal it was when they brought them back?
Yeah. The old McRib and everything that's in there. Weird rotations.
McRib's one I could never do. Yeah. I look at it and I'm like, that looks like it has bones, but it doesn't.
It reminds me of just crappy grade school food. And so I have no interest. Like, not my thing.
All right.
Well, anyways, on that note,
I guess I'll see y'all next week.
All right. See you later. Next week.